Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Tonight's episode is brought to you by the beverage, a delicious hot chocolate. It's really quite delicious. It's spring here, but it's still quite cold, so I'm enjoying it. Part 2, Chapter 20 of Anna Karenina. Vronsky is taking this weight thing seriously, and also general discussion. Sorry that the prompts weren't very prompting for yesterday's chapter. I think it was really late and I couldn't think straight. I am Norwegian, said Petritsky, the more vulgar friend I mentioned yesterday, shows up. The first thing he does after waking up is to order vodka and pickles from Batman. From Batman? I doubt it's just a hair of the dog instead of the start of another day of constant drinking. Techrific said, it's basically Mitya and his officer buddies all over again, and more accurately, Petritsky is a Dolokhov clone from War and Peace. I've got the hiccups. Why do I keep getting the hiccups when I'm doing my podcast? It's very frustrating. I just have to hold my breath while I talk. Dolokhov clone. Yeah, I'm getting some Dolokhov vibes, but I wouldn't say a clone. I'll tell you what, that other character, Yashvin, very well described in such a short time, but I had a really vivid picture of who he was. Although, having said that, I can't really remember what that vivid picture was. But I remember thinking, the cool thing about Yashvin is he's very distinct. He was very kind of happy-go-lucky. What was he? A bit reckless. Probably a better word. Seemed a bit alpha male-ish. A bit of a man's man. And it's things that you could also say about Dolokhov. But at the same time, he was very set apart from Dolokhov. He seemed really different. And the thing I thought was cool was he was a very distinct character. But I couldn't think of anyone in War and Peace who reminded me of Yashvin. He could have easily been in War and Peace and not really encroached on any of the other characters' little niche. Nifty Riffic said, and he fell asleep up there on the roof to the sound of the funeral march. This stood out to me in the chapter. I enjoy funeral marches, the minor key in general, and one of my favourite pieces of music is Mahler's Funeral March Symphony No. 1. Mahler is delicate enough to fall asleep too, I think. We all know the Chopin Funeral March. Was curious about Russian funeral marches and why in particular they capitalized that in the Maud text as though it was perhaps proper and referring to something specific. Some examples on YouTube were nice. Example 1 and example 2, I really like this one, says Nifty Riffic. As for something that would have been the funeral march, let's give this a bit of a bed. As for something that would have been the funeral march, didn't find any one particular song. Korsho said, in Russian, funeral march is not capitalized, and we don't use articles, so it could be any march. In modern Russia, the best known funeral march is also Chopin's. Did I feel more dramatic with the background music? Felt nice, actually. That felt good. I want to do the whole reading with that background music. Should I? I'm not really sure how loud that was coming through. Like, if you could still hear me talking, or how long is chapter 21? Let me have a little peeky sneak here. Oh, it's pretty long. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 pages. That's a 3-minute song. I don't think I can read a 5-page chapter in 3 minutes. Wait a minute. Let me see how long example one is. Also 3 minutes. Oh, well, 6 minutes might do it. Alright, let's have some background music for today's chapter. Anna Karenina. Chapter 21. The temporary stable, a wooden structure, had been built close to the race course, and it was there his mare was to have been brought the day before. He had not yet been to look at her. During these last days, he had not exercised her himself, but had entrusted it to the trainer and therefore did not in the least know in what condition she had arrived or now was. Hardly had he stepped out of the caliche before his groom, who he had recognized it from a distance, had called out the trainer, a lean Englishman in top boots and a short jacket, with only a tuft of beard left under his chin, came to meet him with the awkward gait of a jockey, swaying from side to side with his elbows sticking out. "Well, how is Frou Frou?" asked Vronsky in English. "All right, sir," came the answer from somewhere inside the man's throat. "Better not go in," he added, touching his cap. "I have put a muzzle on her, and she is fidgety. Better not go in, it excites the mare." "No, I'll go in. I want to have a look at her." "Come along," said the Englishman, frowning, and speaking as before, without opening his mouth, swaying his elbows and walking with his loose gait, he led the way. They entered a little yard in front of the shed. A smart, well-dressed lad in a short and clean jacket with a broom in his hand met them and followed them. In the shed, five horses stood in the horse boxes, and Vronsky knew that his principal rival, Makhotin's 16-hand chestnut gladiator, was to have been brought that day and should be standing there too. Vronsky was even more anxious to have a look at Gladiator, whom he had never seen, than at his own mare. But he knew that horse racing etiquette not only forbade his seeing it, but made it improper for him even to ask about it. As he went along the passage, the lad opened the second horse box to the left, and Vronsky caught sight of a big chestnut horse with white legs. He knew it was Gladiator, but like one who avoids seeing another's open letter, he turned and went to Frou Frou's box. "Here is the horse of Mac. I never can pronounce his name," said the Englishman, over his shoulder, pointing with his black nailed thumb to Gladiator's box. "Makhotin's? Yes, that is my only serious rival," said Vronsky. "If you were riding him, I would back you," said the Englishman. "Frou Frou is braver." "But the other is the more powerful horse," said Vronsky, smiling at the compliment to his riding. "In a steeplechase, everything depends on the riding and on pluck," said the Englishman. Vronsky felt that he not only had enough pluck, that is, energy and courage, but, what is much more important, he was firmly convinced that no one in the world could have more pluck than he had. "Are you quite sure that more training was unnecessary?" "Quite unnecessary," said the Englishman. "Please, don't talk loud. The mare is nervous," he added, nodding toward the closed horse box before which they were standing and from which was heard the trampling of hoofs among the straw. He opened the door and Vronsky entered the box, which was dimly lit by one small window. In the box stood a muzzled dark bay mare stepping from foot to foot among the fresh litter. When he had got used to the dim light of the box, Vronsky again instinctively took it at one comprehensive glance, all the points of his favourite mare. That song's kind of annoying. I like the first one. I like the one that Nifty Rick said she liked as well. But the second one was kind of annoying. Anyway, continue. "The mare is nervous," he added, nodding towards the closed horse box before which they were standing, and from which was heard the trampling of hoofs among the straw. He opened the door and Vronsky entered the box, which was dimly lit by one small window. In the box stood a muzzled dark bay mare, stepping from foot to foot among the fresh litter. Sorry, that was probably gross to hear. When he had got used to the dim light of the box, Vronsky again instinctively took it at one comprehensive glance, all the points, took in it at one comprehensive glance, all the points of his favourite mare. Frou Frou was of medium size and by no means free from blemish. She was slenderly built. Her chest, though well arched, was narrow, her hind quarters tapered rather too much, and her legs especially. Her hind legs were perceptibly bowed inwards. Neither fore nor hind legs were particularly muscular, but on the other hand she was extremely broad in the girth, now that she was lean from her strict training. Seen From the front, her cannon bones were very fine and sharp, but unusually wide, seen sideways. She appeared all the more narrow in build because so deep in the breadth. But she was possessed in the highest degree of characteristic which made of degree a characteristic which made one forget all her defects. This was her thoroughbred quality, the kind of blood that tells, as they say in English. The muscles, clearly marked beneath the network of sinews, stretched in the fine mobile skin, which was smooth as satin, seemed hard as bone. Her lean head, with the prominent, bright, sparkling eyes, broadened out to her muzzle with its crimson nostrils. Her whole appearance, more especially about the head, was spirited yet gentle. She was one of those creatures who seem as if they would certainly speak if only the mechanical construction of their mouths allowed them to. To Vronsky, at any rate, it seemed that she understood all he was feeling while looking at her. As soon as Vronsky entered, she drew a deep breath, and turning her prominent eyes so that their whites became bloodshot, looked from the other side of the box at the newcomers, shook her muzzle, and stepped lightly from foot to foot. "There, you see how nervous she is," said the Englishman. "Oh, you darling," said Vronsky, stepping toward the horse and soothing her. But the nearer he came, the more nervous she grew. Only when he reached to her head did she suddenly calm down, and the muscles under her fine, delicate coat vibrated. Vronsky stroked her firm neck, adjusted a lock of her mane that had got on the wrong side of her sharply defined withers, and brought his face close to her dilated nostrils, delicate as a bat's wing. Her extended nostrils loudly inhaled and exhaled her breath, and she set back one of her finely pointed ears with a start and stretched out her black, firm lips toward Vronsky as if wishing to catch hold of his sleeve. But remembering her muzzle, she gave it a jerk and again began stepping from one of her finely chiseled feet to the other. "Be quiet, darling, be quiet," he said, again stroking her flank, and left the box with a joyful conviction that the horse was in the very best condition. The mare's excitement had communicated itself to Vronsky. He felt that the blood was rushing to his heart and that he, like the horse, wished to move and to bite. He was both frightening and joyful. "Well, then I rely on you," said Vronsky to the Englishman. "You will be on the spot at 6:30. "All right," said the Englishman. "And where are you going, my lord?" he asked, unexpectedly addressing him as my lord, which he hardly ever did. Vronsky raised his head in amazement and looked as he knew how to. Not into the Englishman's eyes, but at his forehead, surprised at the boldness of the question. But realizing that the Englishman, in asking the question, regarded him not as an employer, but as a jockey, he replied, "I have to be in Bryansky, but I shall be home in an hour." How often have I been asked that question today, he thought, and blushed, a thing he rarely did. The Englishman looked at him attentively, and, as if he knew where he was going, added, "The chief thing before a race is to keep cool. Don't be put out or upset." "All right," said Vronsky, smiling, and jumping into the caliche, he told the coachman to drive to Peterhof. He had not gone many yards before the clouds, which had been threatening since morning, broke, and there was downpour of rain. "This is bad," thought Vronsky, raising the hood of the caliche. "It was muddy before, but now it will be a swamp." Sitting alone in the closed caliche, he drew out his mother's letter and his brother's note and read them through. Yes, it was the same thing over and over again. They all, his mother and his brother and everybody, considered it necessary to interfere with his intimate affairs. This interference roused him to anger, a feeling he rarely experienced. "What business is it of theirs? Why does everybody consider it his duty to look after me? And why do they bother me? Because they see it is something they cannot understand. If it were an ordinary empty society intrigue, they would let me alone. They feel that it is something different, that it is not a game, and that this woman is dearer to me than life. That is incomprehensible, and therefore it vexes me. Whatever our fate is or may be, we have made it, and do not complain of it," he said, joining Anna and himself in the word "we." "No, they needs must teach. No, they needs must teach us how to live. They have no conception of what happiness is, and they do not know that without love there is no happiness or unhappiness for us, for there would be no life," he thought. He was angry with everybody for their interference, just because he felt in his soul that they were right. He felt that the love that united him with Anna was not momentary infatuation, which would pass, as society intrigues do, without leaving any trace in the lives of the one or the other except pleasant and disagreeable memories. He felt all the torment of his and her position, all the difficulties they were surrounded by in consequence of their station in life, which exposed them to the eyes of the whole world, obliged them to hide their love, to lie and deceive, and again to lie and deceive, to scheme and constantly think about others, while the passion that bound them was so strong that they both forgot everything about but their love. The recollection of incidents often repeated rose vividly in his mind. Where lies and deceptions revolting to his nature had been unnecessary, he remembered most vividly having more than once noticed her feeling of shame at the necessity for his deception and lying, and he experienced a strange feeling which, since his union with Anna, sometimes overcame him. It was a feeling of revulsion against something, against Karenin, or against himself, or against the whole world, he hardly knew which, but he always drove away this strange feeling, and now, too, having given himself a shake, he continued the current of his thoughts. Yes, formerly she was unhappy but proud and calm, but now she cannot be calm and dignified, though she still seems so. Yes, this must be brought to an end, he decided. And for the first time, the clear idea occurred to him that it was necessary to put an end to all this falsehood, and the sooner the better. Throw up everything and let us, too, conceal ourselves somewhere alone with our love, said he to himself. Alrighty, there we go, another chapter down. Thanks very much for listening. I look forward to seeing your thoughts on this chapter, and I will see you tomorrow.